Okay, I think we're ready to resume our conversations, and we're going to talk about five.
Yes. Good morning, board members. So today we have one agenda paper, 5A, to discuss with FICE. And that agenda paper sets out the preliminary scope for the future board discussion on the FICE. Angie will then tee up the paper.
Thank you. So at the September 2019 board meeting, the board discussed the direction of the FICE project and tentatively decided to make clarifying amendments to IS32. So that's an approach that focuses on addressing practice issues by clarifying some underlying principles in IS32 and adding application guidance to facilitate the consistent application of those principles. Under this approach, the board will, when necessary, look to determine what the underlying principles should be so that the principles result in improved clarity and consistency with the rest of IS32. This approach is therefore broader than the work previously undertaken by the IFRS Interpretations Committee, but not as wide as the approach proposed in the 2018 discussion paper or the approach that would be required as part of a more fundamental review of IS32. The board also tentatively agreed on the project objectives and a set of criteria to help determine the scope of the project. So in this agenda paper 5, the staff first summarised the project objectives in paragraph 6 of the paper before setting out the detailed project plan. The project plan outlines the practice issues that the board could address in this project, and deliberating those issues will help the board determine whether there is a viable solution for achieving the project objectives and help the board decide whether to add this project to its standard setting agenda in the future. Although the staff discussed the project plan for classification separately from the project plan for presentation and disclosure, we wish to highlight that both parts will run in parallel. In paragraph 9 of the paper, the staff provide a preliminary list of practice issues related to classification that the board could address in the scope of the project. The practice issues we identified are classification of financial instruments that will or may be settled in the issuer's own equity instruments. So, for example, the application of the fixed-for-fixed condition to particular derivatives on own equity, as well as the classification of mandatory convertible financial instruments. The accounting for obligations to redeem own equity instruments, for example, written put options on non-controlling interests. The accounting for financial instruments that contain contingent settlement provisions, for example, financial instruments with non-viability clauses. The effects of laws and regulations on the classification of financial instruments, the reclassification between financial liability and equity instruments, for example, when circumstances change or if contractual terms are modified, and the classification of particular financial instruments that contain obligations that arise only on the liquidation of the entity, for example, perpetual financial instruments. So in paragraphs 11 to 64 of the paper, the staff analyse how each of these identified practice issues are deemed to meet the criteria set out in paragraph 7 of this paper. And we also provide examples to illustrate how the third criterion may be met. And with respect to the last issue, the classification of particular perpetual financial instruments, the staff recommendation at this stage is that the board explores whether there is a need to take any actions. So if the board agrees, the staff then plan to perform further outreach and analysis to determine whether a change in the classification would provide more useful information to the users of financial statements. In paragraph 65 to 68, the staff discuss the project plan for presentation and disclosure, and are of the view that the board's starting point should be the proposals in the DP. These proposals would be further developed or modified, taking account of the feedback that we received. And finally, in paragraph 69 of the paper, the staff provide an indicative project timeline that illustrates the order in which the issues will be analysed and the expected commencement of the board deliberations on each issue. And we'd like to ask board members whether they have any comments or questions on the project plan and on the indicative project timeline set out in this paper. And I'll now turn the discussion over to the board members.
Just a couple of comments on specificity on some of the topics, if that's all right. So I agree with the issues that you're suggesting that we focus on, so I agree with your list. So I just had a couple of comments in terms of the specifics of two of the questions. So if I look at the effects of laws and regulations on the classification of financial instruments, there's a few different aspects of that that is described in the problem. For example, if I look at paragraph 43, it's talking about statutory obligations to pay dividends, so where you've got things that exist in law. And then when we get to paragraph 47, it's a narrower set of things that we talk about, in particular where there's law repeated in contracts. And so I think we just need to be, not for today, but when we think about this, when you're going forward, sort of clear and disciplined in terms of what aspects that we're looking at. So I think, in just thinking off the top of my head, there's probably three broad categories I would think about, which is where you have a financial instrument and then completely separate to that financial instrument, there's stuff that exists in law. That'd be the first category. The second category is where there's things that exist in law and somebody's brought those into the contract, either on a static or a dynamic basis. And then the third one would be where you've got a contract and then there's the effect of law on the enforceability of the contract. Mm-hmm. And I think it's useful to think about those three things separately, because I think we definitely care about the third one. We definitely mean that you need to think about whether or not the stuff that you've actually written in the contract is enforceable and works in the jurisdiction that it's in. So I think that's a sort of the easiest one. I think the one in the middle is, for me, probably the most difficult one, where you've repeated it in the contract, but it's just a direct repetition of the law, and it's either static or dynamic. Certainly, if I ever get questions, that's the one that people focus on. I think that's the one we probably want to focus in particular. And in the first one, I think our position is that you don't really impute things from law and bring them into the contract and confirming that. But I think it's the second one that's the one that we mainly focused on, if I understand correctly. And then the other one where I just had a comment or maybe a question in terms of the reclassification stuff. So again, I agree this is something that comes up a lot and it's an interesting question, but I just want to be clear about what the scope of what we're proposing there is, because if you look at the relationship between 32 and 9 today, you look at 32 to decide whether something's debt or equity, and then a liability or equity or pieces of, and then the liability bit, if it exists, goes to 9 and you apply 9. So you already have the effect of the modification requirements in IFRS 9 applying to the liability piece. So we've got a whole load of stuff in 9 that already would determine how you'd account for modifications and whether you would derecognise, which is part of the reason, at least, why you would have a change in classification, because if you derecognise and you need to look at what the new instrument is and put it through 32 again, I presume. So is what we're looking at here sort of the population that's not captured by that? So is it equity instruments, because we've got nothing on derecognition of equity instruments at all, and also things that might affect classification, such as nothing's changed in the contract, but you've got a change in your functional currency or something like that, which would change the way you might classify the instrument because of some of the derivative stuff in 32.
I think both of those that you just mentioned were what we had in mind. I think when you have a financial liability, as you said, you have IFRS 9 to begin with, but we don't have any equivalent guidance for equity instruments. But I think based on the feedback on the discussion paper issued in 2018, a lot of people asked about the problem really is when there is no change in the contractual terms, no modification, where circumstances change. I think change in the functional currency was one of the very common examples, but also when an instrument might have had a good option, but it expires, and do you think about it as a change that warrants reconsideration of classification between liability and equity?
And that last one worries me, because that would be a really big change from everything else we do, right? But you'll make sure that we're very sort of compartmentalised in terms of distinguishing those things, because I think it'll be important to be disciplined and to be clear about what the interaction is with the 9 requirements that already exist.
Gary.
Thank you, finally, to the staff. A very good paper. And I have, I guess, 2 questions and 1 comment in it. I'll just make the comment first, then ask the 2 questions. They're sort of related. One is just really dealing with the role of law, and I agree with all the points Sue had made. We're not going to obviously be lawyers, but I think the doesn't mean we shouldn't give guidance on the law that applies. I actually think in the DP we didn't give it the justice it should have. Now, there's in terms of enforceability or the relevance of the law, there's enforceable comes in multiple flavors, one of which is it just poorly drafted, the terms are ambiguous, and so on, therefore it's unenforceable for that. I don't think that needs to be in scope. Then there's contract language that's not enforceable because it's at variance with the law, and the law says you can't do it or it violates public policy or whatever. But then the part of the law that bedeviled me in prior life was, and you see it very frequently in government contracts, but not exclusively to that, is where the law is in the contract, whether it's in the contract or not. It's one thing to take the law and drop it in the contract and say it's part of the contract terms, but I can remember one procurement contract with the federal government I was dealing with. It was 45 pages of cross-references to various procurement regulations that you had to comply with them all. And so on, but they, other than listing the Code of Federal Regulations, it didn't say anything else. But at least that gave you a line to where the law was that the contracting officer believed. But you don't always get it that quick. The law is just there, and it's deemed part of the contract. You might not think of it the way this is written, but it's part of the contract. And so what's its role in there? I personally think the answer is obvious. It affects the contract. T's and C's and recognition measurement. The other questions I had is, and again, I agree with the scope up in paragraph 9. The question is not so much what's on the list. I think that all makes perfect sense. Was at some point in time, can you come back to us what didn't make the cut? I mean, I can't think of anything, you know, personally, but where the, you know, you have 6 items there, I think, you know. How did you get that list? What did you drop off the list, and so on? And I don't, I would just do it in a board paper someplace down the line because the stuff's complicated. It's hard to keep track of. So what didn't make the cut? What are your reasons? I presume the reasons are because it failed the test in paragraph 7, but there's a lot of instruments that are out there. And I think... this will make it, I guess the other one's really a comment on the project plan presentation disclosure. Absolutely agree with working on priority liquidation and the maximum dilution of shares. I think that's very, very important. Spend a lot of time if you've got these hybrid instruments in there. And there's normal priority liquidation, then there's liquidation in the event of administration and bankruptcy, and sometimes the stack ranking changes. And certainly in priority of liquidation, not inside of this project, but just because something's a financial instrument doesn't necessarily get it elevated higher up than, say, an unfunded pension, for example. And so, again, I don't know that you need to deal with that in this project, maybe just try to keep the scope of it. But there are other priorities in liquidation than just financial instruments.
Anne?
Thanks.
Ask about paragraph 6, where you've put the objective following the discussions that we had in the previous meeting. And my question is whether in 6A you say it's to address the known practice issues, and you've listed the 7 that Gary's referring to, the 6 in paragraph 7. So I'm just wondering how the way you frame these objectives, whether really the latter part of 6A and then B and C and DE are how you're going to achieve the objectives in relation to the 6 practice issues?
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Yeah, so I'm just thinking about how this is framed, because really what you're saying is there's an objective and it's to address these issues,
yeah,
and then there's a way you're going to operationalise that objective, and it's by doing these things, one, two, three, four. So I just would restructure that, because I don't think all of that reflects objectives. I think there's an overarching objective that relates to six things, and they're all in the timeline, and then there's the ways you're going to achieve the objectives. And I think it's quite important, because as we circle back and try and work out, have we achieved the objective, well, we were concentrating on these particular ways of achieving what the objective was. So I think it's quite important we state that clearly.
Okay.
Because we were talking in our last meeting about the difficulty of doing this. And one of the things we'd agreed in the last meeting is that we would have points where we would touch base and we would say, are we progressing? Is it possible, or are we getting lost? So I think it's important that we sort out what we've got up there in six.
I think that's fair observation. I think six is a little bit of a mix of, I think, what and how. But
yes.
I think the point that we wanted to make is that these are the things that we want to keep in mind and continue to assess as the project goes.
So probably a minimised or a simpler statement of the 6A first part,
about the
six issues, and then this is how we will do it with a number of steps. I think that would help.
Thank you, Hans. Thanks for the staff, very well and organized paper. That's very professional. I have two questions. Sometimes we refer in the paper to compound instruments, and I think that in many cases, even other instruments, hybrid one, might have some characteristic of equity, despite doesn't get the classification. Just to be sure that we are covering all them, because sometimes we do refer to compound instrument. Just to give an example, paragraph 51, we refer to compound instrument, but I believe that some other hybrid instruments may also fall into the scope. And finally, there is a question actually on paragraph 54, asking whether the board should explore the issue on obligations that only arise on liquidation of the entity. Here is just to reinforce that I think that we should, because I think that you will recommend that the board explore whether the board needs that we need it.
Okay.
Nick?
Thank you. So, very helpful paper, and I agree with the overall direction of the project plan. I think it's great where we're going now. It's probably worth recalling that these issues, from a practical point of view, are often focused in certain jurisdictions and certain sectors. And certainly for some of them, it's quite a rare occurrence that an investor may come across the issue. So, for instance, NCI puts, I can only remember one occasion that it's troubled me. So there is a certain focus. I think there's an interesting question, though, and you raise it in paragraph 62 in relation to perpetual instruments. Is this because the instrument isn't there, or is it a lack of awareness in terms of the ordinary shareholder that they just don't appreciate it's there? And I guess that's why it's important that we're looking at both classification and presentation and disclosure solutions as part of the package here. So overall, great paper and support the direction you're going.
Françoise?
Well, I could say that I would reproduce exactly what Nick has said, except that and highlighting also the issue of perpetual financial instruments, but that I will do that in a different manner. Rightly or wrongly, my perception was that the controversy that the possible change of classification arose played a great role in all the negative comments that we received on the discussion paper. So it's an area of very great controversy, and an area at the same time where our requirements are clear and well understood. So if we want to consider a possible change, I would recommend that we do that very early.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the time the discussion paper was out, people were already, you know, taking into consideration how long it would take us eventually to come to an amendment, how this would affect their financing strategies, whether they should, you know, go to a next issuance and the like. And I think this has created such an unrest on the market that, you know, telling people we are going to look at it, we don't know what's going to come out, but we're not going to do that before the last part of 2020 is just creating unrest for, and I think that should be avoided. Personally, I was not expecting that it would be an item in the list, given the what we heard from the consultation on the paper. But if it is, I would recommend that we deal with it really quickly so that we that people know it's coming, or people know it's not coming, but at least that they have clarity on the issue.
Chen Chao.
Thank you, Esther. I also agree that this is a very good paper and very clear to address the issues and what's the next step we should move forward with this project. First, just comment on Sue and Gary mentioned how to address the effects of law and regulations on those financial instruments. I think it's very important, and to clarify, as you mentioned, three scenarios, because simply based on paragraph 47, clarify whether producing particular legal requirements in the contract terms, I think it's very narrow, and there are another scenarios where it should be addressed. I have two questions about two issues. First, about paragraph 18A, that is the first issue. And you mentioned that you have proposed to add an explanation of the principles underlying the fixed condition. Mm-hmm. And today's example, yep, said that focusing on the position of the holder of a derivative on own equity relative to the holder of the underlying equity instrument. I'm not very clear. That example will be used to as an explanation of the principles underlying the fixed condition, or we are going to improve the principle, or first, you know, improve the principle first, and then use that principle to address the issue of those of the derivative on own equity. Mm-hmm. Or simply use that principle to illustrate the use that example to illustrate the principle. It's not very clear to me. So this is the first one. Second one, with regard to the paragraph 38, I think you addressed a very good case about there is a financial instrument that could be required to be settled at a particular amount, but upon on contingent event occurring. And you raise a question whether that liability should be measured at a full amount of the obligation. So I think there is, that you mean that maybe not correct to measure that liability, that obligation at full amount, because you needed to consider the future probability of those contingent event occurring or not, or the probability should be considered when they measure those obligation. Is it correct that not only just stick to the full amount, actually they needed to be considered the future probability when they measure that obligation?
I think.
What's the meaning of the full amount, your question of the full amount?
Full amount. Yeah. I think in this particular example, the entity could be required to pay the full amount immediately or at any time as long as the contingent event occurs. So I think that the interpretation community discussion on the particular example concluded that then the entity has unconditional right to avoid paying the full amount immediately, and therefore that full amount should be accounted for as liability. Well, I think there is a question out there, or at least some people questions, oh, should I apply IFRS 9 measurement, should I be thinking about the timing at least of the likely payment or not? So I think there is that's just slight questions out there. And I think to answer your first question, I think this was just an example of a way that we might be using to explain what the fixed-for-fixed condition is trying to achieve. So I think by explaining what it is designed to achieve, then we can use that as a basis to continue explaining how to apply then the fixed-for-fixed condition. And then we were then thinking, oh, perhaps we could use some illustrative examples to then apply the fixed-for-fixed condition, thinking about this notion of relative position of a derivative holder and ordinary the underlying equity instrument holder. But this was just an example to give you some flavor at this stage on what we are thinking of.
But I think the idea is definitely to first look at what is the principle, or what do we think the principle is that underlie all of this, and then how to apply that principle in different situations.
Chung Wu.
Thank you. Very nice paper, and you summarized all important. I agree with all the general direction, but as Gary suggested, if you could please give us some kind of issues that has not that didn't pass that criteria in paragraph 7. Because some of our stakeholders who made comment on our discussion paper, they might be disappointed when their issues were not included in the paragraph 9 here there. So if you just saw all kind of data based on that kind of feedback, then we can clearly say this is important. Mm-hmm. So another thing is, this is a kind of targeted improvement standard. If some issues, if we deal with those issues considering some kind of fundamental improvement, or maybe then that kind of issues can be dealt in their coming 2020 agenda consultation. So we can separate these issues, some issues here, some other issues in the more long-term amendment.
Okay. I think if we refer to the September, the previous board paper on the FICE, then we had, for example, under alternative A or the other alternatives, we have described some of the issues that the board might be considering, might be able to consider under debt alternatives. So I think that gives some idea. That should give you some idea as to what are the what were the other issues that our respondents brought up. But we will not be able to. It's unlikely to be within the scope of this project given the board's objective. So that should give you some idea.
Mary.
We will bring back.
Comments on three things. One, on the perpetual instruments discussion. I agree with others and what's in the paper that it's something that we should look at. It isn't so much a unclear how you apply the standard or there are anomalies, but I think certainly the feedback we had on the outreach for the DP put a spotlight on the classification of those instruments as having some anomalies. I'm not at this point saying we must change it. I'm just saying I think we should go back and look at that feedback and do the assessment that you suggest about whether or not we should consider any changes. And as Nick pointed out, if those changes would be classification changes or maybe presentation or disclosure. I support that. But that it's a bit of a different animal from the others because it's responding to what we learned through the DP outreach. On two other items. One is, so the paragraph references, so I have to look to see what they are. Financial instruments settled in own equity, where you do the analysis in paragraph 18. And secondly, the contingent settlement provisions in the analysis you do in paragraph 37. I agree with including them in the initial list of things that we are trying to address. Those two plus those two in terms of difficulty rating, I put at the harder end, and I think those are two that we have to be particularly sensitive about, having the potential to expand the timeline. So, I think when we came back in last month's discussion about how are you going to sequence things and should we or should we not, we decided not initially start with a disclosure-only project, that those are the two that I think could derail timing in such a way that make us think about accelerating the disclosure piece. So I agree with your analysis, but I think we should just be particularly sensitive about those and what the implications of resolving those issues are on timing. I think we need to try and address them. And then thirdly, the late add to that list was perpetual instruments. Maybe the idea of looking at that earlier rather than later to get some clarity out there, because certainly what we heard the first time around is if you're going to change this, as Francois said, there are very long lead times involved, and the sooner that people have some sense if something's going to change, the more it helps them cope with the change and maybe reduce a little the resistance to change.
Yep, I think what we were planning to do is to do some further investors outreach before we bring a analysis to the board, but I think we will see whether we could do it sooner than the planned.
That's on the only liquidation?
Yeah.
The third point, yeah.
Mika. Yeah.
It's about the scope of this project. I mean, I understand that this project will not explore the fundamental modification of any other standards like IFRS 2, but I found paragraph 66B touch upon the disclosure about IFRS 2. I always think somehow IFRS 2's disclosure is not very helpful because it has a separate requirement from the IFRS 32 or other standards. So I think looking at those requirements from the integrating point of view, like what you propose here, seems helpful. And might improve the current disclosure somehow about this area. So I think I agree with this point of view in this project.
Okay. No further comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we do risk management before the break. Yeah.